So, I originally asked you to speak about Jewish business ethics, which I thought was a fascinating topic, and offered some interesting ideas about what sorts of topics should be addressed in that. And I discovered at some point the title was Gay Mission Staying Moral, which is a very challenging topic, which at least half of it I know absolutely nothing about. Namely getting rich. So this is not one of the lectures where I can get up and say do as I do, because I certainly have not succeeded in getting rich. And while it's possible that if I were to get rich, I would say moral, I can't demonstrate to you that any of the advice I'm going to give you is actually effective that way. I should point out that Rabbi Daniel Lapin, who is the rabbi of the Venice Beach Synagogue in California, I believe, and very prominent in politically, the Orthodox rabbi is very prominent in politically conservative circles in America, wrote a book called Thou Shalt Prosper, which he argues that there is a Jewish imperative to grow wealthy. I'm always suspicious of that, and that in fact, if you observe halakha and Jewish ethics, you will inevitably grow wealthy. I'm always suspicious of folks that purport to tell you, demonstrate to somebody, to other people, how you will grow wealthy. Is often the way in which the person is going wealthy is by getting you to buy their book, and or by I write a book in which I say, for example, the way to be prosperous is to invest in yams, and I happen to have lots of yams. So by convincing you that's the way to grow wealthy, I will grow wealthy rapidly. And then the next level that is wealthy by growing wealthy by going wealthy by buying some other vegetable, having sold all my yams to you. So I'm always suspicious about books that provide ready-made paths to wealth. So I want to say up front, I'm not planning to do that. There are a certain set of things that probably everyone expects me to say, and I don't know how many of you have read George Orwell's Shooting Elephants. No? If you haven't read George Orwell's Shooting Elephants, I strongly encourage you to. It's a wonderful essay/short story about such times when you have to do something, but you don't want to do it, and no one really wants you to do it, but just the position compels you. You have to do that, right? You have to do that thing. Rabbis are often placed in such positions where everyone knows that because they're the rabbi, they have to say this, even though the rabbi doesn't really want to say it and nobody really wants to hear it. But it's what rabbis do in situations like that. So when you get up and you give a speech about Judaism and wealth, so the first thing you have to do is make some kind of claim that Judaism does not say things like it is easier for a camel to pass through the eyes of a needle than for a rich man to enter heaven, and thereby set up a happy contrast between Judaism and other religions in that we are in favor of wealth as opposed to other religions usually identified with Christianity, which are religiously in favor of penury and which believe that poverty is the only true way into heaven. So there are ways in which you can do that. For example, verse number one of your sheet, starting with Mr. Yochanan, says, "And I could have started from my stretch pinato, LLG board, the Ashira, because I can't stand out. My God only rests his divine presence on those who are courageous and rich. If you're not rich, then God simply doesn't take you." Right, and Yochanan goes on and says, all the prophets were rich. So we could easily give a shear in which we said that getting rich and staying moral, getting rich is being moral, right? Because Judaism is right, because God favors the rich. We want you to get rich because obviously every Jew aspires to have God's blessed divine presence on you. Now I think that the invidious comparison to other religions is generally unfair. For example, Calvinists were very much in favor of getting rich. And so the identification of Christianity with a particular notion that poverty is valuable doesn't seem fair to me. And there's another poll in Jewish tradition, which is represented by source number two, in which you have a statement from the house of Yanai, which says that when Moses was pleading before God to excuse the Jews from making the golden calf, he said, "God, it's your fault. You gave them too much gold and silver. Anybody gets that much gold and silver, they're going to worship it." Right, it's such a really fascinating, somewhat dangerous analogy. If somebody says this is parallel to pre-Katrina, taking young men, dressing them up, giving them money, putting them down on Bourbon Street at the doorway to a brothel and asking them not to go in. You make people rich, they're going to end up worshiping money. The temptation is too strong. And the identity that usually, because the verse is usually cited to entrench that. So the tradition is in Hadidah Vayishman, Yishurun Vayitah, Yishurun proved that, and then it's sort of kicked off the traces. Okay, so I could also easily give a lecture which says that Judaism believes that wealth is the source of great moral distress. And now we can get rid of that issue and assume the position that Judaism is not in favor of getting rich or against getting rich. Getting rich is a morally neutral phenomenon. You can also find that being poor is also a morally neutral phenomenon. You can find Jewish sources that it encourages poverty. You can find Jewish sources that discourage poverty. We encourage poverty because that way you don't spend your money or time thinking about material things. We discourage poverty because if you're poor, you end up spending your time thinking about money. In fact, some rich people spend more time thinking about money than other people, and some poor people spend more time thinking about money than other people. The notion that your priorities, that your economic circumstances, will automatically arrange your priorities, I think is implausible, and it would be unwise to commit Judaism to any position like that. There's another argument you can make about how Judaism relates to wealth creation, which is to take a Marxist argument and claim that being wealthy is not the right, it may be a morally neutral phenomenon, but the only way in which you can become wealthy is by taking a share of the world's goods that belong to somebody else. Right, so being wealthy is a moral problem because of the inherent inequality, and your job should be, if you have more wealth than somebody else, you should redistribute it so that everyone in the world has an equal share of your wealth. And the problem is not getting wealthy so much as staying wealthy, because you have no right to that. Probably in what we would call a post-Marxist era, where I think that the fundamental Marxist analysis doesn't have so much appeal in the immediate Cold War aftermath, the person who most strongly is identified with this is the philosopher Peter Singer. The Singer solution to world poverty, which gets republished all over the place, in which he basically takes that position. We start on the premise that probably every living being, not every human being, I think that if the child had bank accounts, he would advocate redistributing wealth among them as well. Meanwhile, each human being should view themselves as a trustee for a certain number of cows, and you have your wealth and distribute your wealth accordingly. But he basically takes the position that having more than somebody else is an unfair position, and if you have a more classical Marxist notion, we think that if only we could have equality of wealth, everybody would be happy, it would be great, stupidity is the cause of world trouble, and so being rich by itself, not because of anything that it caused you to do, but the simple fact of holding on to more than your share of world goods is itself a moral problem. Right? There are any number of responses to this. My friend Rabbi Yitzhak Lau wrote an article some years ago in Missions called Rabbinic Responses to Communism. I have given lecture various times on various rabbinic responses to labor and capitalism. I wanted to read with you at the outset one really beautifully sophisticated treatment of the problem by Rabbi Yosef Eliyahu Hengen, who was one of the great halakhic decisors of the early to mid-20th century in America. So, right, this is verse number 3. And there are many of the executive vice president Cohen, declared that one always has to pray for the welfare of the government, because if it were not for government authority, each man would follow his friend alive. Alright, this is often cited as a precedent for Muhammad's notion of Leviathan, that in the state of nature, human beings would beat each other up, and it's only government which restrains them. There's a really interesting comment on this. He says, if I explain this statement to mean, Shabbalah was seen in the Takne Olam HaKadoshim, that this statement of Yechanina came to oppose those, the modern reformers. Right, identified for the Tennis Anaconium in the first century as being as being opposed to contemporary 1930-ish radicals. Why? Those people who wish to build themselves off the destruction of the world and to impose their sovereignty on it, even though they approach world domination by seeking peace, by claiming that they wish the state to wither away right, that they wish all government to go away from the world. It says that the people who wish to argue that we should cause the state to wither away. Right, the third reason they think that causes the need for government is because of the private property, which is sacred to all the earth's denizens, as in the world you find rich and poor, and their jealousy leads to wars and quarrels, whereas if everyone shared one pocket, they didn't think in the course of their idiocy, there would be no need for dominion. Okay, if only we had communism, if there were no wealth, if everybody had an equal share of the world's goods, then there would be no need for police force, because all crime, all interpersonal wrongs, are created by inequality. Right, which his response is, he says this is really true. In fact, he says private property is the only thing that keeps the most powerful people physically from controlling the world. Money is a counterbalance to other forms, right, to other forms of power. And he says, furthermore, even if the whole world was voluntarily formed like this would remove only a small portion of jealousy, namely jealousy of money, which is apart from the person, whereas jealousy of strength of character, of beauty, and of all the superiorities one person may have over another, right, those would still remain. And so we need to have some kind of government, some kind of forceful restraint of people in the process, because there is no capacity to really solve it. God did not make human beings equal in a practical sense. God made human beings equal in an ideological sense. All men are created equal, but granted the moral equality to start with, right, money is not the cause of jealousy. Right, money is a way of giving introducing yet another element of power into society so that the jealousies can be restrained by other people. Right, I think this is a wonderfully sophisticated response to communism, and it basically accomplishes the notion, right, saying that wealth per se is not a source of evil. Inequality of wealth in society, seeing that as a profound moral wrong that needs to be rectified, is a really simplistic vision. In fact, everybody has more of something than less of another, or the potential to have more of something than less of another, and the question is whether the resources of a society are used to redress imbalances of power, or to accentuate imbalances of power. Right? The issue is power, not money. Okay. So I'm going to start by saying that I think that money as such is not a moral issue. But it is a contemporary issue. By contemporary, I would say in the last 100 years or so, but it's been accentuated over the past 50. There is a way in which money raises perhaps a more serious issue, which is the rise of the limited liability corporation. Those of you who are students of economic history knows that corporations were strongly opposed by all systems for very good reasons. Until I think somewhere in the late 19th century, because people had this strange notion that corporations can inevitably lead to economic bubbles. They're going to explode and lots of people get hurt. Shocking notion. But one of the other issues that was really raised by the corporation, corporate personality. The way we set an economic system is you and I are people, and Exxon is a person. And Mobil is a person, and General Motors is a person legally, right? Within commercial transactions, the thing that I have, and General Motors is not the aggregate of its shareholders. General Motors is a person. It's a really interesting question whether halakha recognizes, whether halakha acknowledges the existence of corporations, or right, who have their own personality, where the shareholders are not liable personally for the debt of the corporation, only the corporate assets are pledged to it. Really interesting question. People have written back and forth over the past 100 years to see whether halakha acknowledges it. The only model we really have for a corporation in halakha is the temple. And the temple has legal personality in halakha.
here's the moral challenge set up by corporations. And the problem is that rich people on the whole tend not to have any of their own money, really, but they own or share in corporations. So what happens if you have, what happens in a corporation? So let's say I take my $1,000 and I invest my $1,000 in shares of General Electric. This is my plan to get rich. I have invested. I encourage you all to go buy General Electric. So as you can see, if I stay moral when I get rich. I just totally worried about it. Now, that $1,000, right, when I was deciding how to spend it, I had all sorts of moral duties. I had to figure out how I was trying to figure out whether my $1,000 was doing what was going to do good or evil. Now, General Electric has my $1,000. Now that means the decision of what to do with my money is no longer made by me. It's made by the board and officer of the General Electric. Now, what are the moral responsibilities of the board and shareholders, of the board and officers of the General Electric? To make more money. Right, they have a fiduciary responsibility. I gave them my money to make money for me. And in fact, right, if they use my money for moral purposes as opposed to for financial purposes, I can sue them. Right, because they have their fiduciary responsibilities. So for example, if I had invested in Ford, and Ford decided that really the best thing they could do with their money is, let's just stop building gasoline-powered cars and let's start building electric cars. That way, there'll be a lot fewer gasoline-powered cars, and there'll be some electric cars, and we're out of money in 2 years, or months, days. Right? So meanwhile, we've been advancing the environmental agenda. Right? So what happens if Alan Mulally, I think, is the CEO of Ford, decides to go with that strategy, and he knows perfectly well that this is not a winning economic strategy because he thinks, for example, that the gas prices are going to stay at $1.80 instead of going back up to $4. And really, what Ford was doing is building the same kind of SUVs that was making it money 2 years ago. But he wants to do this because of environmental accounts. I can sue him. Right? If it was shown in advance that he did that knowing full well it was economically destructive, it probably could be criminally prosecuted as well. Now, when all the decisions in a society, right, as to how to dispose of money are being made by people whose primary moral duty is to the people who gave them the money and thereby to make more money, you have a moral problem. Right, so there is an issue in contemporary society that wealth is controlled by corporations. Usually the wealthier you get, the greater percentage of your money is given over to other people whose primary responsibility is to make money for you. Mutual fund managers, and unless you specifically put it in one of these pension funds, which I tend to think are not terribly helpful anyway, because corporations are so complicated. The notion that any specific corporation can be defined as that's the moral corporate corporation to give money to. Let's suppose that Enron is really good at recycling. Right, does that mean there's an ethical company to invest in? It strikes me as very puzzling. So the issue what needs to be developed thereby is the notion of what we call moral fiduciary responsibility. The idea that when somebody gives you their money, the presumption is not only that they're supposed to make money for you, but they're supposed to make money in an ethically responsible fashion. And there it happens that there are some jurisprudence that create a really interesting model for that. The model for this, for fiduciary responsibility in Jewish law, is dealing with the estates of orphans. It's a given that every time someone dies, right, and leaves money to children, somebody has to be the guardian of the estate. The guardian of the state has the same kind of fiduciary responsibility that offices of a corporation do. Their job is to preserve the money for the children, and ideally have more of it ready there. The interesting thing about halakha is that halakha does not only place the executor of the state in a responsibility, fiduciary responsibility to the orphans. It places the whole of society and the government in fiduciary responsibility to orphans. Which means that the estates of the orphans in principle cannot be taxed. Because paying taxes is not in the interest of the estate. The interest of the state is to have more money, not less. So, right, now the problem with that is that in, let's suppose you live in a small town. In a small town, very likely most of the taxes are paid by 4 or 5 people. Really small town, most of the taxes, the whole society is going to be run based on the taxing of the one richest person in town. What happens when that person dies and their children are 8 years old? The whole town collapses if they can't, right? Because you can't collect taxes from children. So you have to find some mechanism for claiming that charging taxes even to the state of orphans is in line with your fiduciary responsibility. Okay, so there are a number of places in which there's basically two strategies that are adopted by Al-Khazi. These all appear in source four introduces the notion of a notion of fiduciary responsibility. Source five tells you that even though you're not allowed to take money from orphans, you can take money from orphans for civil defense. Because the rule is that you can tax the estates of orphans for anything which they derive benefit from. Now, what's the category of benefit here, though? Are the orphans derive direct benefit from defenses? You have no idea if they derive benefit from defenses or not. You don't know anyone that has access to them. So there seems to be some notion that fiduciary responsibility includes the idea of creating a society that is the kind of society this person should want to live in. So I think that you have a model there for you can try and figure out how expansive you want to make it for a notion of moral fiduciary responsibility. Then you have a somewhat more interesting way out, which is that there was one time when the rabbi put the charitable donation on the orphans of a particularly rich man, and he was challenged and said, how can you challenge him? He says, how can you impose charity on them? He said, well, because I need to preserve their social status. Right? Because people's social status depends on how people, depends on their being seen as contributing to society. Now this is what enables corporations to legally give money to NPR, for example. Because it's a thing that creates goodwill. Right? So we have that model in America already. But there again you have another way in for creating a moral fiduciary responsibility to claim that part of the interest that people have in their money is the way in which they are perceived as society around them. And those are two ways out. Basically that notion of moral fiduciary responsibility has to be generated in order to prevent a corporate society from becoming an amoral society. And practically, they have an attempt to do this through shareholder initiatives and things like that. These have almost no success at all for various practical reasons. And so I think the only way to do it is to develop the notion that when you have somebody's money, you always have responsibilities, significant positive responsibilities that go above and beyond making them more money. Okay. But what about the techniques that you can use to make money? Right? Are there issues, moral issues there? So here again, I emphasize the obligatory resources. Those of you who are really interested in market economics should be aware of the work of Aaron Levine, who is a Milton Friedman student, who is a free market person in a Hawking perspective, and Meir Samaras in Israel, who is somewhat less of a University of Chicago person. And basically, they're looking at it and saying, you know what, on the one hand, Halakha recognizes the legitimacy of profit, and beyond that, and Halakha doesn't like it when you take unfair advantage. And the only issue is, in every system, what does it mean to take unfair advantage? They have in source number 6 the notion of that God condemns those people who hoard fruit, or charge usurious interest, or fraudulent measures, or who gouge prices. That sounds very nice, except that price gouging is always a real concern. Right? What does it mean to price gouge if you're willing to pay? Right? Well, I don't think it's only worth what people are willing to pay. So in what sense am I price gouging? My wife and I have this argument regularly about whether it is immoral to raise prices on umbrellas when it starts raining. Right? Although, umbrellas are worth it, but it's not raining. Right, when it's raining, some people want umbrellas. So of course the price goes up. Well, then more people want umbrellas. So I argue, and this is where we get into the morality, I argue that it's true, but on the other hand, it's not that umbrellas are really worth more, it's that you are here, you want to go there, and this umbrella right now is worth a lot to you. And the person is taking advantage of your being held in an environment where there's only one seller of umbrellas. Right, if there are two sellers of umbrellas, right, if you're inside this desk in the mall, there are two umbrella sellers, thanks to the umbrella stay exactly the same, they can all go back to the margin and make a profit on. But if you're trapped in a store and only one person selling umbrellas to you, they can charge you as much as it costs to get wet. Right, and so if you look at the history of all this, basically, often you will find people reciting ridiculous and resources that demonstrate how I think resistance to price gouging, but they're all... But many of the people, what's your price gouging, and all those that down to your moral intuition, that when you think you're taking unfair advantage of the lack of the market. Right, so I gave you the choice number 7, one example in which somebody threatened to change the halakha, or at least to change the public perception of halakha in order to lower prices. There's another famous Mishnah in which somebody threatened to change the halakha, in order to increase the supply of a particular phenomenon. And you have all sorts of cases through the ages, but let's say people used to charge exorbitant prices for bread immediately after pickup. Not like apparently I just found out from a napkin in my local pizza store that apparently some store auctions off the first pizza after pickup every year on eBay, and they give like $700 for it. So that's a charitable auction, so it's probably, right, it's probably not price gouging. But if you look at all the cases, where rabbis intervene sort of and engage in price fixing to prevent price gouging, it always comes down to two types of cases, I think. One is where you're dealing with price gouging in religious articles. The issue we have is not that you're charging too much money. The issue we have is that you are putting your priority of making money over the public interest in having certain types of materials available affordably. Or vice versa, where we want to prevent you from selling things cheaply because we want to make sure that the people who sell those things, right, make a living. Right, for example, we would be, right, I think that this probably, if you know, we're an organized revenue, we might be deeply unhappy about the market news the trade store on eBay. I'm happy about it because hopefully someday I'll be able to afford it to deserve. But when you recognize that tribes make very little money as it is, right, and so the international market used to trade Tura is massively depressing the market for news to trade Tura. Right? So it might be that rabbis would have intervened. There was a time, obviously.
How much did they pay for Tura on a
For one, that it's restorable about $3,000. Right, restored, I think, 6 or 7, whereas the newspaper Torah is about 25 to 30. So this is really a real issue. Rav Abadi, famous 40 some years ago, took the position that you could still screen for Torah. This was roundly rejected in large measure because it was dead space, which is fine, as the position of the free Chaim, I think it is, who argued that printed the free Torah would be valid. So you find that one intervention there got like intervened to lower the prices of the price. The classic market intervention was requiring that trophies could be sold in sealed boxes so that people wouldn't go into the Ushkizan model, you know, paying $10,000 for the best that trophy and back there themselves, even though people could do it. That seems to have now we sell the boxes, they're going to open the boxes. Okay, so we have the form of the wall, but not the reality of it. The other thing is when you're dealing with staples, right? So in an economy, let's say, where in fact you can bread in a famine, right? In fact, you can get lots of money. You can get lots of money for bread, but it's against the public interest to allow people to charge, right? To allow people to charge lots of money for bread. And this is where you reenact what you say did in Egypt, which I think we should have a moral problem about. Right, where you corner the market and then you sell back to people at very high prices. So you'll find rabbis intervening about that. The interesting question is whether in those circumstances what you claim is that the individual person can charge whatever they want, and there's a social responsibility to legislate, right, so that people
know when they've gone too far, but there's no individual moral responsibility. Right? That's really the crux of the issue. So we claim that when you figure out, if I set up an escrow extend, do I have to say, well, you know what, even though people would pay me $120 for an escrow if I wanted to, I'm only going to charge $70, right? Because if they pay $120 for their escrow, the odds are that $50, 10 of it would have gone to pay school tuition, and 10 of it would have gone to charity. Right, and so here I am. I am sucking money out of the orthodox economy. I just said it's probably not so reasonable an expectation. And really, what you discover is that mostly there is a societal responsibility to regulate. And people can go ahead and make money as long as they can on a pay if people willing to pay. And society is responsible to regulate it. The issue is, and this is a contemporary issue: what happens when we have no social mechanism to regulate? Right, so people, right, the Jews, are not accountable to anybody. So there is nobody to tell you that you are charging too much for a shogun, or you're spending too much on bar mitzvahs, or anything like that, in any socially responsible way, because you're destroying the economy. So maybe that imposes a new responsibility on people with money to consider the social consequences of their choices, even though classically that would not have been necessary. Okay, all these I think are ancillary issues because there's really one key issue which is central to me, which I think is all about is what the moral factor of wealth is, which is that wealth enables you to employ people. And there's two ways in which wealth affects wealth is a morally significant phenomenon. One is that wealthier people their actions are magnified. The same moral choice that somebody who has $1 million and somebody who has $10,000 has different consequences. And let's suppose if somebody who makes $10,000 a year decides to give 8% of their income to charity instead of 10%, so how much money gets sucked out of the economy? $20. If somebody with $1 million decides to choose that, right, then all of a sudden, right, you're talking about $20,000. That's a lot more. Furthermore, it might be that we would say that people who make $10,000 a year really were perfectly fine if they give 2% to charity. That's a purely moral choice. If you make $1 million a year and you're giving 10%, that's insufficient. Because there's so much more that you can do when you have other assets, there's one issue. The second issue, in addition to magnification of consequences, is that people who have lots of money tend to control other people's working lives. They tend to have employees. And the thing that I want to set up really is that the primary way in which wealth and morality intersect is that wealth gives you power over other human beings. Having money is morally neutral. How you get the money, the ways in which you get it are not significantly different to Judaism than any other religion. But the core issue is having gotten the money, how do you use the power that money gives you in relation to other people. And to both these species, the notion that publicity or magnification consequences is critical, and that if money is centered on employee uses, can be centered in two famous cases involving Orthodox businessmen. One of which presumably all of you know, and that's where, if you don't, then arrest do better job. is of course the Rogoshkin's meat factory. Where you have this massive coalition legitimately created because of the abuse of the workers in the plant. And we have a choice, when you run a plant, you have a choice. It's always likely to make more money if you pay workers less than something. In many cases, certain industries are really skilled, childbearing workers, but on the whole, in unskilled physical labor industry, you might very well gain more by lowering labor costs. And a massive coalition was created by Rogoshkin's failure to create a supervisory mechanism for the way in which workers are treated in the plant. Which frightens me, I guess. How many of you have heard the iron jurisdiction? Two. That's it. Three now, right? So then you have Rogoshkin's debacle, referred to now everyone's image of what Orthodox businesses are like in the public eye. But 14 years ago, Aaron Pierce, who was the proprietor of
a fabric manufacturer called Malden Mills in Massachusetts had his plant burned down, and he decided to pay all his workers. And while the plant was being rebuilt, and furthermore, even though it would have been to his economic benefit to take the insurance money for the plant in Massachusetts and rebuild the plant in the south, he decided that his responsibility to the workers was to rebuild the plant as is. This became a national, in the same way that the Boschkins became a national nightmare for the image of Nazi Judaism and the all of the time. Aaron Turstein became the most massive sanctification of God's name that the Orthodox community has seen. He was featured at First President Bush's State of the Union address, and that was great. And so if you have, you know, you see, that if Aaron Turstein had owned a small shop selling handmade scarves, or Aaron Rogoshkin had owned a corner grocery shop, no one would know anything about them, and it wouldn't matter so much. And seeing their same types of consequences, and the way in which the primary moral consequence of having money is that you have the capacity to choose how you treat employees. So I want to spend, I guess, the next 25 minutes or so doing is to try and set out one of the two areas, or all I think has something really unique to say about an economic issue. I think also has something unique and very powerful to say about what the relationship between employers and employees is. And I want to set that out for you and, you know, set it as a model, but that's really that should some of you actually end up being rich or having your own influence in ways other than money, I would really hope that you would internalize this and take this as one of the primary purposes of having power. So there's the first number eight. There's a mission in Novi Mesira. There are two Krishna. It's not all true. It's talking about there's some kind of instance in which workers are hired by a middleman, and they somehow feel legitimately that they are getting less money than they had initially been contracted to receive. Although everyone agrees that they're not getting unfair wages. Okay, right? Fair wages. It has to be some kind of case in which they have been somehow promised above market wages, right? And in the end, they get paid market wages instead. And so the issue is, right, so they have no cause for economic complaints because they're getting paid what anybody else would pay them. They're getting paid the what's called the community standard wage, the prevailing wage. Prevailing wage, that's the contemporary term, although in contemporary economics the real issue is the distinguish between the prevailing wage, the prevailing union wage, or the prevailing non-union wage, depending on whether you think union distorts or correct economics. So we're dealing with a case where workers were promised in some way by a middleman to get more than the prevailing wage, and the Mishnah says that although they have no cause for legal complaints, they have a cause for moral complaints. That's a very interesting notion, right? We admit up front, this is certainly a very important issue, we admit up front that there are societal wrongs that we will not legislate to overcome. They're wrongs, but they're unforcibly wrong. And the Talmud suggests that one possible understanding of the case is that the worker could say, you're right, I'm getting exactly what my work is worth, but I could have worked for myself, and there is a loss in working for somebody else, the loss of dignity, in working for somebody else when I could have been working for myself. That's a very powerful thing. We're going to play that out a little bit more. I want to look at that claim. That there's a cause to moral action. If somebody tricks you into doing work for them that makes you exactly the same amount of money as if you had done that work for yourself, because you could have argued that it was beneath your dignity to be an employee. Okay, that's just a very powerful notion. I want to skip to number 9 now and go on to verse 11 and play that out in what I think is a really rarely beautiful piece of Talmud. They are kind of nice, but there's a whole debate about what Talmud is. Right? Is Talmud a sort of the
the existence of the group of the Talmud, the rabbis, the conversations take place in the Talmud in exactly the way, like somebody was just taking notes and they took down the conversation the way it happened. That seems increasingly plausible. Or whether you view Talmud as a literary construction, somebody took the argument in a particular order because they wanted them to develop. And they wanted to move in a particular way. I have significant differences in just religion of any of these issues, but on the fundamental notion of that there is an element in which the Talmud has to be viewed. Literally is an awkward term because I think that it's one of the primary differences we have, and I think that Talmud is largely a written rendering of a text that still exists in your mind. It's not actually a written text, it's an oral text. It happens from God written down. But I want to take a look at the way in which this text develops. So when verse number 11 begins, you're not going to repeat what both said. If you pick up a lost object in order to acquire it for somebody else, the somebody else has not acquired it. Okay? I walk down the street and I see a Rolex watch. And I think to myself, you know, I don't want a Rolex watch. I had an expensive watch once. I lost it. And okay, I still feel bad about that. I don't like having expensive things. My friend Joe Weinstein likes expensive things. Rolex watches particularly. Right? So I see this watch on the street. It's a Rolex watch like all other Rolex watches. Nobody could identify it as their Rolex watch. And I imagine that much of New York has improved since I lived here, that it is still the case that people who abandon, who drop Rolex watches on the street don't really expect to get them back. Right? So I have halakhically perhaps a legitimate right to acquire this Rolex watch, but I choose not to acquire it for myself. I want to pick it up and I say I hereby acquire this Rolex watch on behalf of Mr. Weinstein. That doesn't work. It doesn't work. I can't do that. Even though I could have acquired it for myself, I can't acquire it for him. Okay, why is that? Because I am not really a Mr. Weinstein's agent, I just appointed myself as agent. As we have a category called constructive agency halakha, it is I'm allowed to do something that benefits you. Okay, for example, if somebody just walked over to me and said, "Right, will you take this $10,000 for Mr. Weinstein?" The answer, I say yes. And the moment I acquire the money, it belongs to Dope. Right, because I'm allowed to be an agent even without authorization as long as I'm doing fine with that system. So the rule is I can't do that, but I can't do that if by benefiting him I'm harming somebody else. Okay? I can't do things on behalf of one person when I'm not explicitly their agent, which harms other people. And we say, guess what, when I pick up the Rolex watch on the street, I am depriving all the other people who could have picked up the Rolex watch of their fair share of the bread of the finding. Right, so I can't pick up a watch for somebody else because that would be acting as an implicit agent when there's a third party harm. Okay, this doesn't interest us so much, we just want to set up the parameters. But then Rava comes along and says to Rav Nachman, this statement of yours is wrong. I know perfectly. In fact, you are allowed to pick up the watch for a third party. How do I know this? It says that if a worker, I know what you mean in the Hebrew probably, just to keep it, a worker who finds things gets to keep them himself, right? If the worker finds objects, they belong to him. But then Dharma Morin, when is it said, this man shamar lo abar l'vayet nafesh mi hayom adori mi hayom. If the employer told him, I want you to hold this field with me today, I want you to lead this field with me today, then if he finds the watch belongs to him. But if you're just hired as a day worker without a specific task, then if you find something, it belongs to your employer. Okay, so other fish are not going to say, look, somebody is hired by the day, right, looks at the old watch, picks it up. The employer did not say, I hired you for the purpose of picking up Rolex watches.
So we see that you can acquire an object on behalf of a third party. Right? So you're wrong when you say third party can't acquire objects. And here, Malcolm gives a fascinating answer. He says, Shani Toil is Okiya Talabayasu. So now workers are different because workers are considered simply to be physical extensions of the owner, of the employer. Now I want you to think about this is really a very complicated notion, because it's not really true. Because if workers are just considered to be an extension of the employer, then why is it that when I pick up the watch, when I was hired to do a specific task, why am I still not just an extension of the employer? What I'm really saying is that workers who are hired for their time are extensions of the employer. Right? Whereas workers who are hired to do jobs maintain themselves independent personalities. Okay, now that may just be a random economic idea with no moral consequences. But then Rava says to Rava, you can't say that. You can't say that employees are simply extensions of their employers. Why? Because we have a rule that says that the contracts are never binding on employees. Okay, this is the rule in American law is the rule against specific performance. That's the term. So let's suppose that you hire me to fix your roof. Bad idea. Alright, let's suppose that you hire me and you say that I'll pay you $10,000 to fix my roof. And I say fine, and then I start fixing your roof. And after about an hour I say, wow, this is not fun. And I leave. Now you're looking at me and say, no, we have a contract. I hired you to fix my roof. So you put the police and say, look, he's breaking the contract. Force him to fix my roof. You can't do that in American law. You can't do it in Holocaust. Right? Contracts are never binding on employees. Now, I might be liable for damages if you can't get somebody else to fix your roof. And you were counting on me to fix your roof before the rain came, or you were in a season with a seasonal rain. Right? And I leave you with your roof open, so you can sue me. Right? You can make me pay you for the damage caused by my breaking the contract, but you're never allowed, I don't know how it's in American law, you're never allowed to make somebody do work that they don't want to do, even if you have a contract with them. Okay. So Rav says to Rabbanan, you can't claim that workers are extensions of their employers because workers always have the option of not working. Okay. Interesting claim. Why does this necessarily contradictory? Why don't we say that workers are extensions of their employers as long as they have a contract? When they break the contract, it's not being extensions of the employers. Okay, so Rav Nachman comes along and says, you know what? He says exactly that. He says, guess what? As long as you have the contract, you're an extension of the owner. But then, at this point, Rav Nachman says, end of the conversation. He says, you know what? I don't understand what your claim was originally, right? You made this ridiculous claim that an employee can't be an extension of an employer because he can back out of the contract. He hasn't backed out of the contract. So Rav Nachman says, no, that's not true. I agree with you. I agree with you that in principle, somebody who can back out of the contract, somebody who's not bound to do the work, maintains independent personality. Right? But he says, and really in principle, a contract is binding on employees. And we should be able to enforce it. I should be able to make you do the work, and that's why you become an extension of my hand. But he says there's another reason there. The reason that we allow you to back out of your contract is not because is not because that teaches us something about the relationship. Rather, it says, "Kama finahu b'sir, ki libnei Yisrael avadim, avadayim, v'lo avadim l'avadim." So the reason for this is that there's a verse in the Torah that says, "The Jews are my servants, and they cannot be servants of human beings." Okay. This is the text you have. I want to show you the hierarchy that this text sets up. The person who is least, rather the person with the most independent identity, is a person who is hired to do something. Right? That person, right, is never an extension of the employer. Okay? A second person is somebody who's hired for their time, and that person is an extension of the employer. Okay, but even that person, who in fact has become an extension of the employer, is still allowed to break their contract, even though they really are just an extension of the employer, because if we didn't let them break their contract, that would violate the verse, because Israel, Jews are my servants, God says, and not servants of servants. Okay, who can tell me what is absurd about that verse?
You read that verse the first time, right? You should have looked at it and said, that's ridiculous. Well, if you read the verse, you could have said, the Jews are my servants, okay. Jews are my servants, and there are other people's servants too, right? You can serve God as a human being. But the rabbi said the verse, for the Jews are my servants, means that Jews can never be servants of other human beings. They can never be hafazim of human beings. Why is it ridiculous? Yeah, because there are three different chapters, right, three different sections of the Torah, which tell you about the laws that a Jew becomes heavy to another Jew. Now, I presume the rabbis were not ignorant of this. And therefore, it's really quite striking that the rabbis would take this verse as meaning that Jews cannot be avadim of other people, when they know full well that there are three sections of the Torah that describe that. Now, the rabbis may also have been aware that anybody know where does the first discussion of Jewish avadim occur in the Torah? Where in the Torah does that occur? Yeah?
Legal question.
No, legal question occurs Parshat Mishpatim. Right? Parshat Mishpatim, which is right. It's the first thing that God tells. It's the first thing, the first law that God gives to Jews, really. The first thing the law here to regulate Avadim, and right, it comes right after the Ten Commandments, which begin, I am the God who took you out of slavery. And that's a fascinating notion, right? That the first law, the God who asks you to be permanently, right, to be permanently indebted to Him for taking you out of slavery, the first rule He gives you, and when you enslave each other, this is what you should do. And that's really a striking contrast, and it's that contrast that enables the rabbis to make the claim that there has to be two different categories of avdus, and even though there is something that we call an avdus, right, nonetheless there has to be some kind of avdus which is so deeply immoral that we would owe God deeply for taking us out of it. So I want to set this notion up the following way. Obviously we have, the hierarchy really goes this way. You have people who are hired to do jobs, people who are hired for their time, and then we have people who are hired for their time and paid in advance. And that's what a Jewish, right? That's what a Jewish method is. It's somebody whose labor is capitalized in advance, and you get paid 6 years of work in advance. The difference, the reason they're getting paid in advance is, right? Yes?
Yeah,
what does the employer mean? The employer means you get paid in advance. And, good, let's play this out. So the rule is, if I hire you for your time in advance, I can break the contract in the middle of the day. Right, you pay me, you hire me, so say, you give me a contract to work for $6 for $25 an hour, after 3 hours I quit, you pay me $75, I leave. Slavery is, I hire you to break, is here's $150, work for me for $6. Now the rule logically is, even a Jewish slave, if after 3 hours I want to quit, if I can give you the $75, I can break the contract. Now, the reason it's slavery though is that I'm not allowed to leave if I can't pay you back the wage that I got in advance. So the way Jewish slavery is constructed in the Torah is really just payment, it's wages in advance, it's figured out as a daily wage.
The action
is that we get? Yeah, well, look, you get wages in advance. We figure out when was money. You tell yourself, right? So you get the money. If you tell yourself, you get the money.
You didn't get a check.
Yeah. I guess a check is at the beginning. You put it in the bank account. And the very opposite is invested in multinational corporations that make weapons. Well, yeah.
Get a check.
In advance.
Never read that.
You tell yourself, right? You tell yourself to what?
What about,
good. So, very important to understand, when the Torah allows of Jews, it doesn't allow that kind of slavery. They won't, right?
That's why it's a slavery for a term of 6 years. And right, and it's right, and we figure out the selling price. The slave debt, because you know what it is, I have a huge debt. I owe $9,000. Okay, I need $9,000 in cash. It would take me 6 years to earn that money. Meanwhile, my credit card starts revolving, my family can't eat. So instead, I say, you know what, give me the $9,000 now, and I agree to work for you for 6 years. So I pay off my debt. Right, that's what slavery is. That's what legal slavery is. Illegal slavery, the kind of... The only slavery of Jews in Europe. Not just a good issue. Not just slavery is a conversion issue. It's not really a slavery issue, I think. So Jews are only allowed to own non-Jewish slaves if the slaves sell themselves willingly, if they agree to adopt Jewish religion, where they will slaves willingly. There's a whole set of conditions. It's not a good idea to compare them. The kind of slavery that is talked about by the rabbis when they say Jews can't be slaves is that kind of slavery. Right? Jews can never be in a position, the rabbis teach you that the verse that says that Jews can't be slaves teaches you that you can never enforce contracts, right, to make people do labor. Right? And even when we have this category called slavery, you still can't enforce the contract. The only difference is that since you've been paid in advance, until they return the money, you can enforce the contract. Because they've already taken the money. But the rule of Jewish slavery always is that if you can return your wages, then you can leave. Okay. So the way in which this directs, so the way in which the hierarchy this sets up is the lowest permitted form of employment. The one which is closest to slavery is if you're paid in advance, and so it's deeply unlikely they'll be able to return the money and get out of the job. Right? Then, the category which is very close to slavery, which is why, when the Talmud uses the language that an employer hires for their time, their hand becomes like the hand of the employer, well, that means they're taking us very deliberately from another Talmudic section that says the hand of the slave is like the hand of the master. Right, so it means that people who are hired by the hour, people who are hired for time, are closer to slaves. They're not slaves because they haven't, right, because they always have the option of walking away, but we understand economically often people don't have the option of walking away. Right, you're right, people do really horrible jobs, still don't really have the option of walking away, but at least they have the fact that they can walk away from your job and work for somebody else to do the same thing. Okay? So they don't get to choose what they do, but at least they get to choose who they do it for. Okay? And above that, the person is not like a slave at all, and so therefore they can't acquire objects for you. It's somebody who gets to choose not only who they do it for, but what they do. Okay, they're hired for a specific task. Okay, so I want to say that this is a model. This is a model for a halakhic employment method. And we'll start with that you have. First of all, you have the notion set out in the Talmud of Nicaea that there is an inherent loss of dignity in working for somebody else. Okay, so all employment carries within it the moral risk of slavery. So all employment carries within it the possibility that I will have to substitute someone else's will for my own. And the primary conception of the human being, obviously, is a person, is a being who has the capacity to make choices, your own choices. Anytime you subordinate your will to somebody else's will, you're giving up the dignity of what makes you a human being. Now we understand that because of the way in which society is set up, even though it might be in a wholly ideal society, this is where people always quote the Jubilee year in Slovakia, we might have the Jeffersonian democracy as our ideal system, in which everybody is a private landowner that farms their own land. But we're not opposed to capitalism or industry such that we believe that it's impossible to set up a right that we condemn any society in which some people have money and thereby are capable of hiring other people. But within that framework, we have to understand that any relationship in which you have the capacity to get other people to do your will because you have power over them imposes a profound moral risk to slavery. Okay, and therefore we say the ideal system is one in which When you hire people for things that they want to do anyway. Right? And even if, right, so when you have an employee, the first responsibility you have is to try and create workplace autonomy. Right, to try and enable employees to be able to make their own decisions to the extent possible. And you have to balance that with, you want, right, you know, that if your employee decides that what they want to do is play into that poker, right, what you need them to do is make widgets. Right, obviously, right, obviously, you're not going to pay them if they keep doing that. But the goal, as somebody with power over people, is to try and constrain their choices as little as possible. The second thing is that you want to make it, as easy as possible for them to leave. Right? You want to make it possible for them to walk away. And that is also played out in two other aspects of legal systems. One of which you'll find in sources 14 and 15, and the other of which you'll find in source 16. Sources 14 and 16. Set up the situation with the requirement that you pay workers on time. Why is it such a moral imperative to pay workers on time? I want to suggest the reason for that is that if somebody's working for me and I haven't paid them, they can't afford to leave. Because if they leave, they have no hold over me. So not paying somebody on time is really a blackmailing them into staying. And so the halakha requires that you always pay employees immediately as soon as they've done the work, so that they now have a completely free economic choice about whether to continue the relationship. The second is a severance pay. Is whether people, when they leave here, on the presumption that most people make only enough to subsist. So building in a cushion in which when people leave, they have what we call unemployment insurance. Right? That is a way of making sure that people have the capacity to change jobs. But, you know, just put in a commercial. Anybody tell us what the obvious small issue in America that really sort of is? Employer-based healthcare. Employer-based healthcare has the effect of making it extremely difficult for people to leave jobs. And I think that there is a Jewish imperative to find ways, not necessarily to go to a single parent model, but to find ways in which the provision of health care through employers does not become a means, which it is right now, of locking people into jobs that they don't want to do. Because they can't, because either they have pre-existing conditions, or because they simply can't afford the health care premiums for the to leave their jobs. That strikes me as one of the most powerful ways in which halakha could contribute to contemporary discussions. I have two other things I want to do in this topic. One is, you take a look at verse 12 and 13. Verse 12 teaches us that you're not right, that you're not allowed to work a Jewish slave, mitarah. Okay, now tarah literally is understood to mean in a way that breaks them into pieces. And you would think that would set a halachic prohibition against requiring excessive physical labor. Right? I can't make my workers bang a heavy hammer for more than 5 hours a day. But the rabbis didn't understand it that way. The rabbis said that what back-breaking labor means, labor that has no purpose except gratifying your ego. Alexander Solzhenitsyn in the Golden Archipelago has a really powerful story. I think it's the Golden Archipelago, maybe in one of the, I'm not sure. A worker in the Gulag who turns this really heavy wheel for years and years and years, that's his job. He does it happily because he knows that the wheel that he's turning is running in the brain and it's feeding the whole city. But even though it's not the job he wants, he's doing it because he's a prisoner and they can force him to do it, but he finds the energy to do it because he is doing something productive. And after 20 years he's released, and he goes outside the wall and he sees that actually the wheel doesn't make it to anything. And he dies on the spot. Because he can't deal with the notion that his work was, that his work was purposeless. So the rabbis say that back-breaking labor is not work that is too hard. It's when it's obvious that people are asking you to do things
solely in order to demonstrate that they have power over you. Right, when I ask you, when I tell you to dig here, right? Go, for example, go dig that hole until I get there. Not go dig that hole to a particular depth. Dig that hole until I get there. It just means that, right, it means that they are using their money to, they're using their money to be able to show that they have the power to substitute their will to yours. Right, now the rabbis say that that is forbidden to do to slaves because slaves have no capacity to defend themselves. They can't really leave. It's legal to enter into contracts to do that. Now the moral situation is, obviously, that the more power you have over people, the more cautious you have to be not to utilize your power in a way which generates substituting of your will for theirs. Okay, you have a whole set of moral imperatives built around the value of autonomy. And A, is that if you're hiring somebody, right, you have to pay them more than they would make if they were working for themselves, because they have to get something for the law of dignity. Secondly, you have to set up the workplace in a way which maximizes employee autonomy so that they are as much as possible making their own choices as opposed to making the choices you want. Thirdly, you have to make it so not only within the job do they have as much autonomy as possible, but they have as much autonomy as possible as to whether to continue in the job. Fourthly, you have to make sure that the job, as much as possible, is aimed at a productive purpose which they would see as valuable, as opposed to simply gratifying your own ego. The last thing I need to do is I need to quote one other source which people always cite in this context, and I think that they misunderstand. So I wanted to refer to that's source number 9. It's probably one of the most popular contemporary stories as follows. There's a rich man, Melibar Barkanon, who hires some shepherds to carry a barrel of wine for him, and they break the barrel of wine. Okay, we're not told whether this text, whether it's negligent or not, but they break the barrel of wine, which it seems clear that they are liable. They should be liable for paying for the barrel of wine. There's some elements of fault. Okay, and what he does is he refuses to pay their salary, and he takes their clothing as compensation for his lost wine. So they have no money. So he takes their clothing. And they come to court and they say, we want our clothing back. And he argues that they owe me the money, right? This is the only thing they have. So I'm seizing, right? I'm a creditor and they're on for clothing. And so Rob tells them that no, you have to return the clothing. And he asks them, is that the law? And Rob says, yeah, the law because a verse in Proverbs says they're supposed to be a good guy. So then, emboldened by this, they say, you know what? Now that you want our clothing back, we want you to pay us. Even though you paid us to carry that bottle, that barrel of wine, and we dropped it. So, and Ralph tells them, guess what? Give him the salary. And Ralph Rahamuzin says, what are you talking about? Right? What are you talking about? And he says, the end of that verse. Says again, he told me you're really good guy. Okay, so this is often cited to demonstrate, you know, that really we don't like the rich, we like the poor. And so when the rich and the poor come to court, right, we to the rich, we say things like, behave morally and we're going to enforce it on you. Now that is unfortunately, both a morally problematic notion, because in fact it's practically morally it's a really bad idea to enable the courts to make decisions on some basis other than the law. Because the only thing that keeps the rich money from controlling the poor is law. And if you start allowing law to be made on, right, legal decisions to be made on the basis of what you conceive of as equity, as opposed to on the basis of law, then the poor lose their only protection. So it's a really bad idea for the poor to do this. Secondly, it's against the Torah. So the Torah says, this is your first understanding, and I'm going to take this to mean exactly that logically, you're not allowed to favor the poor in a lawsuit. So we realize that these are problematic some of these things. How could Rav have enforced against the blind merchant the law that saying or has he enforced the requirement that he return the garment and that he pay their salaries when in fact legally neither of those is real? The answer to this, I think I learned when my mother was being a lawyer for at a major law firm for insurance company. And directly for bankruptcy insurance companies. And so there's a phenomenon in American law called the set-off. The set-off is as follows. So I owe you $100, you owe me $100. We can just say, you know what? We don't owe each other anything. Okay, that's fine. Or let's suppose you owe me $150, and I owe you $100. I say, you know what? Just give me 50. That's fine.
Well, where it breaks down is, where, right, what happens is I owe you $100, and you owe me $100, and then you go bankrupt. So now, if I give you $100, am I getting my $100 back? No. I didn't give you my $100, and my $100 is going to be split among 100 people you owe $100 to. But you don't have enough money to pay me back. Right? So if I give you $100, I'm never going to see it again. On the other hand, if I try and look, you always have $100. I get my, right? I get that back. So am I allowed to do that or not? So that saves many lawyers like another lot and lots of money. Or did my mother was doing that. To try and fight about whether that should be or not. My understanding of this passage is exactly that. Everyone agrees that the porters owe, let's say the wine barrel is worth $100 and their wages are $1 a day. Everyone agrees that they owe, that the workers owe the employer $100. On the other hand, everyone agrees that the employer owes the workers $1 of their wages. What he wants to do is say, you know what, I'll keep the dollar, you owe me $99. The question is, do we choose to allow him to engage in that kind of setup, or do we say, no, you pay them $1, and they'll pay you $100 when they get it? All right, so what Rob did here is what he said, you know what, I'm not going to allow the setup. I'm going to say, you pay your debt, and then we'll set up a payment of their debt for their debt on the installment plan, because there's no reason that I should allow you to offset your debt against theirs. Now, this is a very important principle generally, that justice can often be affected through procedure as well as through substance. A case I like to talk about like this year that came out for me once was when there was a case of somebody, particularly the case of a woman who was in a bitter divorce, and she had been, she thought, I think very likely correctly, she had been fleeced by superior lawyers for her husband, and who had left her, basically she had gotten nothing out of the marriage in which he had been, which he clearly had been at fault, and therefore she refused, but the only thing she left that she had was that she was refusing to accept the religious divorce from him. And he wanted to get remarried. And so he came to the very court and asked us to compel her to receive a divorce. And they just said, you know what, we're stuck. Because on the one hand, they thought that really he was being, right, really, what he was doing was he was preventing her from selling the house, which was the only asset she had, and therefore, since she couldn't sell the house, she couldn't raise the money to appeal the decision. So there was a really unjust situation being created, which the only way she could remedy it was by using a weapon that we could not allow to use, because if you ever allow people to, right, to refuse to accept a human divorce because they feel that they have been robbed in the divorce case, then you can never solve their business problem. Everyone will claim, the reason everyone does claim, the reason I'm withholding a divorce is not because I'm a bad guy, it's because they stole all the money. So how do you handle this case where you have this, right, where you have this, on the one hand you have to tell her if she has to accept the divorce, now, on the other hand, you have to tell her that you have to sell the case. We did was, we told her that we would sell her to accept the divorce and as soon as the case came to court, and we gave her an appointment in 3 months. We wanted to get married in 2 weeks.
So, right, maybe that's how we also procedurally. We managed to create a situation in which you had justice and whatever ruling that she had the right to turn down the divorce.
Okay, I just want to set that up. There really is no set. The goal is to create a social system in which, within the limits of the law, which are critical to protecting the poor against the rich, we nonetheless manage to enable equity. Okay. Sorry, 1 minute.
1 minute. Okay. I'm running out of time. If you like this kind of analysis, which has a number of key elements to it, one is a really rigorous policy analysis, which is open to the insights of every other discipline, economics, anthropology, political science, and two. If you want to learn halakhic materials in a way which takes responsibility for the way in which they will affect the real world continually, right, learning in a responsible way, and get to understand how the decisions that you make as a society affect the way halakha turns out, and I hope you'll have you'll take these brochures on the table there also, and consider applying for the Sunday Drash program, and also that you'll look up the website There's a brochure for the whole organization at www.thoroughleadership.org, which has lots of other lectures like this, and information about other programs. If you email me or sign up for the list there, we have a campus program in Boston. We're trying to extend that to be an East Coast program. And if you're interested in helping us organize a Shabbaton this spring, which is the first major Saturday, it'd be great if you would find give us a way to be in touch with you. And thank you all very much for coming. Okay. Yeah, are you old? I just started the question. You have to get an answer. You're on the email answer, because I'm going to your account. Why is it making money? I mean, to the truth is, office we're getting off your assets and our income, but we tend to treat it as income nowadays, but gifts are income.
And then all of that,
is that kind of an issue that you're offering it to you? I think so. I really shouldn't go to your account to the special services to try to subscribe your account.
Yeah, you can just pass along. Thank you. and formal survey by the state retail council found that sales over the Thanksgiving holiday weekend were as good or better than last year by half the stores. New York City tax rebate checks may seem to be bad. Grocery may feel in the worst of turn off those $400.
The attendance to those series is dropped off.
I promise you, we as a people will get them.
It is. I think it was, maybe one of the people there was on the night. You know, that's all that is. It's just a lot of time. Not much work in a little picture.
Hey, I'm Kramer. Remember, it's a virtue. Picking up on value is a
sin. Okay, anything else there?
Thank you. they determine what they want to say. I don't remember which one, but it's,
Thank you.